Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom, from Central Florida to all of you wherever you're listening, and we do appreciate your interest in this ministry, as we mentioned from week to week. Many of you are listening in California, and you may have an interest in the origin of the freeway system. Well, if you look at Genesis 1, verse 30, we see that God created everything that creeps. For those of you who remember the old King James translation of the Bible, in 1 Corinthians 15, 51 and 52, "Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep. Or I show you a mystery," I think is what the old King James says. "Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, at the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump." I imagine a lot of politicians wish that they've seen their last of Trump. All right, enough with the wordplay. I want to make another comment about politics, which is going to be, to some degree, my topic today, by mentioning the fact that back in 2008, we had a candidate for vice president who was a devout Sabbath keeper, and he actually got more popular votes than his opponent. He lost in the Electoral College. For those of you who are not in the United States, the Electoral College is an interesting system that we have for electing a president, and once in a while a person gets more votes but loses in the Electoral College. Anyway, Joseph Lieberman was a devout Sabbath keeper and ran for vice president of the United States. Now we have another Sabbath keeper, a neurosurgeon, Dr. Ben Carson, who wants to be president, and he's a Seventh-day Adventist. And that leads me to comment about something that happened to me this week. I finally got to a public library and looked at the Anchor Bible Dictionary. Now I want to recommend to you the Anchor Bible Dictionary. This is a scholarly dictionary, and it's written by people who know the Bible better than any of us but don't believe in it. These are liberal scholars. Some of them believe in taking the Bible seriously but not literally. And in any case, but the Anchor Bible Dictionary is the very scholarly Bible dictionary that you would use in a university level class. And there's a wonderful article which came out ironically at the time when the Worldwide Church of God was abandoning the Sabbath. At that very time is when the Anchor Bible Dictionary came out with an article on the Sabbath, a brilliant article, and I had never read through it, and I finally did. So I would like to recommend that you go ahead and do that, that you go ahead and sometime I may comment on it in a sermon or Bible study, but that you go ahead and read the article on the Sabbath in the Anchor Bible Dictionary. It was written by a brilliant Seventh-day Adventist scholar, and he obviously must have been a very brilliant scholar to get into the Anchor Bible Dictionary. But he was born in Germany, came to the United States, and unfortunately he died prematurely. He died in an automobile accident in 1994. But his name was Gerhard F. Hassel. Gerhard F. Hassel. And he was a Seventh-day Adventist scholar, wrote an article on the Sabbath and the Anchor Bible Dictionary. I would, recommend that to you. Well, obviously, you believe in keeping the Sabbath, many of you, and you are here in this room or listening wherever you're listening. And even if you're not listening on the Sabbath, most of you who hear me do believe in keeping the Sabbath. And I would heartily encourage you to continue with that. As a minister of Jesus Christ, we are considered, in a certain sense, ambassadors. We ministers. I want to go to 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 20. Today I want to talk about some historical material, but relating it to the issue of politics. Politics can be a very rough and tumble business, a very dirty business. And in many societies, of course, it becomes violent. In fact, even in our country, the United States of America, we've had assassinations of politicians. Actually, America was traumatized in 1963 by the JFK assassination, and in some ways that affected that whole period. But there were other assassinations after that. There were several of major and minor figures during that decade, which I lived through. But in 2 Corinthians 5:20, we ministers. Now then, we are ambassadors. So let me first talk about the subject I want to cover today, because as I said, it relates to politics. I want to cover the fall of the Northern Kingdom. Just to give you a bit of background, historical background, the Bible has a lot of history. It's there for a reason, and we may not always understand why it's there, but we need to read it, study it, and derive what lessons we should out of it. And if we discuss it among ourselves and think about it, we may find more insights into the material. But I want to talk today about the fall of the Northern Kingdom, because nations rise and fall, empires rise and fall, and if a society becomes corrupt, that is self-destructive. It can come because people tend to get lax, and over time, because of the laxity of the people rise up from that corrupt society, and corrupt people become leaders. That's one way it happens. Another way it happens is if you have leaders who are corrupt that then affect the society. They influence the society. If the elite is corrupt, then people begin to follow the elite. You know, they say the fish stinks from the head. So that's another way it can happen. It can happen because the leadership gets corrupted and influences others, or it can happen because society itself becomes lax and ultimately people come from within the society, rise up, and from a corrupt society, you get corrupt leaders. There's an expression that a nation gets the government it deserves. Maybe you've heard that concept. The nation gets the government it deserves. A wonderful author named Friedrich von Hayek wrote a book back in 1944, a classic, The Road to Serfdom. He talked about the rise of totalitarianism, communism, fascism, Nazism. The Road to Serfdom is a libertarian classic. And Friedrich von Hayek, in one of the chapters of that book, talked about how in a totalitarian society, not the cream rises to the top, but the crud rises to the top. And he shows why. If you're in an organization which is abusive, which is bullying, which is oppressive, you're going to find a certain type of person begins to know how to play the angles. He begins to understand the rules of the game, and he claws his way up to the top, he or she. And so what you have is not the wonderful people at the top, but you have often less than that, far less than that at the top. I'll make a comment now, somewhat of a controversial nature. A very great teacher of mine who isn't living anymore, but a minister and mentor of mine, told me that as he visited the various congregations which are called by the name Church of God, and there were various ones. You know, there was the Church of God Seventh Day, the Seventh Day Church of God. You know, there's, of course, the Worldwide Church of God. There's these various, you know, Churches of God. His observation in general was that he felt much more comfortable with the average lay member than with the leadership. So you take that for what it's worth. Anyway, 2 Corinthians 5, verse 20. Now then, we are ambassadors for Christ, we ministers. As though God were pleading through us, we implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. So I want to give you some advice as a minister, as an ambassador for Christ. My advice is to stay out of politics, not to get involved in this world's politics. This is my advice to you. How would Jesus vote for president? He wouldn't. This is what I'm telling you. And I want to go into some verses along those lines. Let's go to John 17, the prayer of Jesus Christ before his arrest and crucifixion, and how he describes the church. And it's awkward. It's not the most pleasant thing. You'd like to fit in. You'd like to go with the flow. You'd like to be like everybody else. But everybody else is going on a self-destructive path. That's the problem. We want to be different. We want to be heading for eternity, not for eternal punishment, but for eternal reward. In John 17, verse 15, I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. So we don't run away physically. We're not hermits. Jesus was popular for a time. you know, before he began preaching intently, and then he had his detractors and his supporters. But just as a person growing up, he was beloved, he was popular, he was respected, well-liked, etc. I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. So we're set apart by the scriptures. So where the scriptures are acceptable to civilization, fine, we'll fit in. Where the scriptures are not, then we'll be a minority that are, in a sense, dissenters. We'll be, in that sense, dissenters, those who differ. So we're in the world, but not of the world. Let's go to Hebrews, the 11th chapter, and verse 13. This is one of the lessons of the Festival of Tabernacles that is coming up very soon. We'll be keeping it in Washington, D.C. Hope you can join us. It just struck me as interesting. I told you to stay out of politics. Well, we're not going to D.C. We're not going to see to D.C. to run the place. We're going for education. We're not trying to run the place or decide how it ought to be run. Hebrews 11 and verse 13, talking about our spiritual ancestors, the saints. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. So that's our spiritual status, strangers and pilgrims on the earth, resident aliens in a sense. So we are not going to be running the world now. But that doesn't mean that we can, let's say, be a law unto ourselves. That is very wrong. We've got to be good, loyal, patriotic citizens of where we live. We love our country. We love our neighbors. And we obey the law. We're law-abiding people. We're not disruptive. We're not troublemakers, Christians. Christians are not that way. Romans 13. Romans 13 and verse 1. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Verse 7. Render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Respect your leaders. Pay your taxes. Be law-abiding. Be good citizens wherever you are. Even though you are not politically involved, but you are law-abiding good citizens. And pray for those in authority. Pray for their safety, for example. It's a very dangerous world. As I said, I lived through the assassination of many influential figures. And so have you, if you've lived any length of time. And then we have other things that can happen, you know, just airplane crashes and things of that nature, automobile accidents. As I said, this great scholar, Gerhard F. Hassel, he died in an automobile accident in 1994. I think he was 59 years old. Could have lived a lot longer and accomplished a lot more. I want to go to 1 Timothy 2. Therefore, I exhort, first of all, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. So if somebody's in need, pray for that person. He doesn't have to be, you know, a member of the church. If you're aware of some need, you know, you pray for that person. Therefore, I exhort, first of all, the supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. For kings, this is verse 2. For kings and all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. We need to have police. We need to have fire department. We need to have law and order. We need to pray for those in authority. And Paul says, verse 3, for this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior. On the other hand, sometimes, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, sometimes our conscience, our understanding of the Bible, and our commitment to God will conflict with civil authority. Those times sometimes occur. And in that case, we don't rebel and and try to, take out the sword and the rifle. But we sometimes do have to disobey, and then we can try to escape the consequences if possible, but we may have to suffer the consequences if we're not able to escape them. Acts 5 and verse 29. But Peter and the other apostles answered and said, "We ought to obey God rather than men." So sometimes it does come down to that. So I hope I've given you an introduction as far as a Christian perspective on politics. And I want to go a little bit now into the political history of the covenant people, the people of Israel, and particularly of the northern kingdom once the kingdom split into north and south, Israel and Judah. I want to talk a bit about the fall of the northern kingdom. And let me say that a nation should not fall into corruption, because corruption is self-destructive. I want to go to Proverbs 14 and verse 34. Proverbs 14, verse 34. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach, a disgrace to any people. So a nation which is known as a law-abiding nation, an orderly nation, a peaceable nation, that nation is respected and exalted. And a nation, of course, that is a corrupt nation is disgraced, wherever it is, whatever it is, whatever the color, whatever the continent. And unfortunately, the people of Israel knew better. They had a covenant with God. They had prophets. They had scriptures. And still, they went in a very negative direction. We had the dynasty of Jehu, which was promised to be four generations, and then it came to an end with an assassination. I want to go to 2 Kings 15 and verse 13. And the reign of Shalom. I'm in 2 Kings 15 and verse 13. Unfortunately, as Israel was corrupted, their system became worse and worse, and it broke down into factions that became violent. And so there were violent overthrows of the government. And of course, there was intrigue with other nations of that part of the world, and people, making deals. You know how that happens. You start out as a conflict between brothers, but then one brother begins to lose and he brings in some outside force. It maybe that wasn't his original intent. Let's settle it within the family. But then when you begin to lose, then you bring other people in, and then it really gets sorted. You may recall in the American Revolution, one thing that really upset the colonists was when the British hired German mercenaries to come over here and fight. That really did bother, the colonists. Now, the good news is some of them hung around, and stayed in America. And I know one family, wonderful family, church members that descended from the Hessians. And they were from Pennsylvania, this family, but I knew them out in California. But anyway, you start out with conflicts between segments in a society, and then they bring outside forces in. So let's take a look at the ancient Middle East to a degree. Things haven't changed much. I mean, the news we read now is much like what I'm going to read to you here. That's what's sad, but it shows human nature tends to just continue to run its course, But if you look at the ancient Middle East, you had the Israelite kingdom was divided, Judah to the south, Israel to the north. And the north of Israel on the coast was what we would call Lebanon today, the Phoenician people, Tyre and Sidon. But then as you go a little bit inland, you come to Aram, Syria. You come to Syria with its capital, Damascus. So Syria was an important power at that time. Then you go further east, you come to what is today Iraq. And in those days, the southeastern part was where the Chaldeans were. And in the northwestern part was where the Assyrians were. So around the town of Mosul today in Iraq was the ancient city of Nineveh. So in northwestern Iraq, you had the Assyrian Empire. It was rising at the time. Of course, south of Israel then also was Egypt, which figured in politically. So you had Egypt, Syria, and then Iraq, and then the two Israelite kingdoms. So that's a rough look at the situation. There were also neighboring peoples in what is the country of Jordan, who often tended to be hostile to the Israelites. Those neighboring peoples were there too. So it was a cauldron, just as the Middle East is today. And so we had the assassination of the King Zechariah by Shalom, and evidently it was a conspiracy, and he was able to do it in a public way and then assume power. So it was a coup d'etat, we would call it. And so in verse 13, so Shalom, the son of Jabesh, became king in the 39th year of Uzziah, king of Judah, and he reigned a full month in Samaria. I think there's a little bit of irony here. You know, this murderer, this usurper who was conspired and had developed a following and then got rid of the monarch, he only ruled about a month. And then somebody else came along. And this person probably had support from the Assyrians. So you're right, there was intrigue going on. There were the Syrians to the north and the Assyrians further east, and they were competing for influence over Israel. Is everybody still with me? Let's do it. Let's talk about it in modern language. We have Syria and Iraq, and we have Israel, and we have both sides trying to influence Israel. Okay, have I made it more contemporary? All right, so let's go to verse 13. Shalom, the son of Jabesh, became king in the 39th year of Uzziah, king of Judah, and he reigned a full month in Samaria. And Menahem, I guess Americans call him Menahem. For Menahem, the son of Gadi, went up from Tirzah, came to Samaria and struck Shalom, the son of Jabesh, in Samaria and killed him, and he reigned in his place. So now we have Menahem ruling, and there are more records about Shalom that we don't have. It's very likely Jeremiah put this material together, and he mentions there's historical records that we no longer have. Verse 15, now the rest of the acts of Shalom and the conspiracy which he led, indeed they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. Now Menachem needed to consolidate his power, and he acted ruthlessly. And I want to say that, you know, rarely do saints occupy political office. I mean, it's just not the way the system works. You may come into the system a saint, but the system works on you. And in order for you to rise up the line, you know, you have to, in effect, learn the rules of the system. So you may start out a saint, but you may not end that way. Now, I would say that there may have been sometimes people who came into the system late, and maybe they weren't fully conditioned. They came in, you know, as not people who hadn't, you know, grown up in this with the system. And so occasionally you have a refreshing change, you know, at times. But anyway, let's go to verse 16. Then from Tirzah, Menahem attacked Tifsah, all who were there and in its territory, because they did not surrender. Therefore he attacked it. All the women who were there with child he ripped open. Horrible! Why would you do such a horrible thing? To intimidate anybody else. They didn't surrender. This is what they got. So you'd better toe the line. That seems to be, that's the idea there. In the 39th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Menachem, the son of Gadi, became king over Israel and reigned 10 years in Samaria. But even though he consolidated his rule, but he followed along the way the earlier kings had followed along. And he was not keeping the covenant of Israel with God. He was a sinful ruler. And therefore the people were continuing in their sins. Verse 18, and he did evil in the sight of the Eternal. He did not depart all his days from the sons of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. All the way back to the beginning, the first king of Israel, of the northern kingdom. Now, at the time that Menahem was ruling, there was a subordinate who seemed to have a fairly free hand and was exercising authority in the eastern part of that country. It was almost like there were two segments of Israel, the segment in the west under Menahem and the eastern segment under a man named Pekah. And evidently, Pekah was more pro-Syrian. But Menachem was maybe pro-Assyrian. Well, the Assyrians leaned on him, and he paid them tribute. He didn't fight them. He paid them tribute. So Tiglath-Pileser, who also was known as Puru, and here in the Bible he's called Pul. Pul, the king of Assyria, came against the land, and Menachem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver, that his hand might be with him to strengthen the kingdom under his control. So he made a deal with the Assyrians. He paid them off. He collected from the wealthy under his control. He pushed them to he exacted a tribute from them, which he then gave to the king of Assyria. And that helped him to consolidate his control because, as I said, he had a subordinate who was very powerful in the east, and I guess he couldn't get rid of the guy, so he just kind of gave him authority over the eastern part of the country. And in order to consolidate his authority, he made a deal with the Assyrians. And Menachem exacted the money from Israel, from all the very wealthy, from each man 50 shekels of silver to give to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned back and did not stay there in the land. Now the rest of the acts of Menachem and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? So Menachem rested with his fathers. Then Pekahiah, his son, reigned in his place. And now that Pekahiah was ruling, Menachem was gone. Now Pekah in the east figured it's time to make his move. Evidently, Pekahiah did not have the same authority that his father had. He was evidently weaker, and this was a time when of a more vulnerability. So just after 2 years, Pekah struck. So now we have yet another assassination. In the 50th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekahiah, the son of Menahem, became king over Israel and Samaria and reigned 2 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Eternal. So once again, the country just continues on that path. And it's so sad because they knew better. And he did evil in the sight of the Eternal. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin. Verse 25. Then Pekah, the son of Remaliah, an officer of his, conspired against him and killed him in Samaria, in the citadel of the king's house, along with Argob and Ariah, or the lion. Maybe that was a special title a man had, or some nickname that would have been known to the readers. But these were evidently two prominent people that were assassinated along with them. Or maybe these were, I would say that these were people that that were assassinated with the king. And with him, which is with Pekah, were 50 men of Gilead. And so this was from the eastern part of that nation. So they consolidated control. East and west were now united under Pekah. He killed him and reigned in his place. So Pekahiah was killed by Pekah, and now the kingdom's consolidated, but now we have an anti-Assyrian in charge. Somebody wants to work with Syria against Iraq. You still with me? He's pro-Syrian, not pro-Assyrian. And meantime, Judah is to the south, and what they want to do is force Judah to join them so that they would have a consolidation of Judah, Israel, and Syria against Assyria. You still with me? Now the rest of the acts of Pekahiah and all that he did, indeed they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. In the 52nd year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, became king over Israel and Samaria and reigned 20 years. And some of that, as I said, was while the Menahem and Pekahiah were still alive, evidently. And he did evil in the sight of the Eternal. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. But now God was beginning to really step in. You know, in the United States, we had a period of time called the Roaring Twenties. And there was a kind of breakdown in morality at that time. Now, there were also some extremes on the other end that I wouldn't necessarily encourage. But we had, at the same time as this breakdown of morality, we had on the books prohibition. You know, so it was kind of ironic what was going on. We had prohibition, don't drink alcohol. But meantime, we had, the so-called Roaring Twenties. Well, you know what followed? What followed was the crash and the 30s, the depression of the 30s, and then the Second World War. And in one sense, that did rebuild in some ways the character of the United States. The 1940s are now called the greatest generation, the generation that liberated the world from tyranny. And they gave us the 1950s that in some ways were a relatively positive period, in some respects. But in any case, I wanted to just kind of show you the parallels, that when societies get corrupt, there's a price to pay. And sometimes they can get back on track. Many times they You know, sometimes there's a, you know, recycling, like, for example, Victorian England. Evidently, there was Elizabethan England that was kind of on the wild side. Then later on, there was Victorian period. And that's when the British, they might have been outwardly very reserved. But at the same time, that's when Britain ruled the world. The sun never set on the British Empire. One fourth of the world was British by the end of that period. Anyway, I've said a mouthful. But I want to go to Isaiah, the 7th chapter. And this is a messianic prophecy, so famous. But you know, the context is this historical period I'm talking to you about. Even though it's a famous messianic prophecy, and I'm not going to go into it all, but the context is this period when Israel and, in the north and Syria conspired against Judah to the south and actually invaded. And there was a civil war going on. Israel versus Judah, north versus south, with the Syrians helping the north. And it looked really bad for the south. I'm in verse 5 of Isaiah 7. Because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have plotted evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and trouble it, and let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves, and set a king over them, the son of Tabel. Thus says the Lord Eternal, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. So God intervened, and Judah was spared. But Ahaz was not a righteous ruler. So Judah was spared, but not in the best of shape. Because Ahaz was not a righteous ruler. But God did intend to save Judah. And after Ahaz came Hezekiah, who was a righteous ruler. So I'm going to read now verse 8. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken so that it will not be a people. So this was around 735 BC. So around 65 years later, there was no northern kingdom. It was virtually gone. Virtually everybody was gone from there. There was a mixed people there. Some Israelites had remained. Of course, some had fled south. And some remained mixed with the Gentiles that had replaced them. And so we had a people called the Samaritans, a mixed people. But the bulk of the tribes, the 10 tribes were removed, and the area was depopulated of Israelites. The 10 tribes were forced to migrate further east. And so they became known as the 10 lost tribes. So by the time of the king Esarhaddon, in the early part of the 7th century BC, by the time of Esarhaddon, there was no, Israel didn't really exist as a separate entity. Verse 9. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. Believe me, I'm telling you, you're going to get through this. And Ahaz did get through it. But on the other hand, Ahaz did not really change and become a righteous ruler, and so he got through it, but not well. There was still a price to be paid. But let's go back now to 1 Kings 15:29. I hope all this history hasn't just been too much, you know, strain on the brain, as it were. But you can go back and review this material, and hopefully you will. That's the point. We need to have a database. We need to know what's in the Bible. 2 Kings 15:29. In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Eon, Abel, Beth-Maacah, Janoa, Kedesh, Hatzor, Gilead, and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive to Assyria. So now we find the Assyrians occupying the northern kingdom, taking captives away. We already have this beginning to happen, the fall of the northern kingdom. Now it has actually been invaded and conquered by a foreign ruler. And so it's, so you could just imagine at this point, you could see why the people would be very disgruntled and perhaps rise up against the ruler and try to throw out the Assyrians. Or maybe you could say a pro-Assyrian would take over control so that the people could work something out with the Assyrians. Since this enemy of the Assyrians had brought the Assyrians down on them, maybe now a pro-Assyrian can take over. Now, before I get there, I want to go to 2 Chronicles and go to chapter 28 there. Just a little bit more about this war that was going on between Israel and Judah. Second Chronicles 28. Um, Let's go to verse 5. Ahaz was a sinful ruler. You see, the southerners were also sinful. So God was punishing both houses of Israel. Therefore, verse 5, therefore the Eternal, his God, delivered him into the hand of the king of Syria. They defeated him and carried away a great multitude of them as captives and brought them to Damascus. Then he was also delivered into the hand of the king of Israel, who defeated him with a great slaughter. For Pekah, the son of Remaliah, killed 120,000 in Judah in one day, all valiant men, because they had forsaken the Eternal God of their fathers. So sin does bring reproach on a nation. Zichri, a mighty man of Ephraim, killed Maaseiah, the king's son. Azricam, the officer over the house, and Elkanah, who was second to the king. And the children of Israel carried away captive of their brethren 200,000 women, sons, and daughters, and they also took away much spoil from them and brought the spoil to Samaria. Now at this point, many of them, as I said, they were no longer a united nation. Some were pro-Syria, some were pro-Assyria, so some were more sympathetic to the south, probably some were more hostile to the south. And so there was not a unity in the country, and the country was in a state of chaos at this point. And in verse 9, but a prophet of the Eternal was there, whose name was Oded, and he went out before the army and came to Samaria and said to them, look, because the Eternal God of your fathers was angry with Judah, he has delivered them into your hand, but you have killed them in a rage that reaches up to heaven. In other words, you've gone way too far in this. And now you propose to force the children of Judah and Jerusalem to be your male and female slaves. But are you not also guilty before the Eternal your God? Now hear me, verse 11. Therefore, in return the captives whom you have taken captive from your brethren, for the fierce wrath of the Eternal is upon you. So you're also going to suffer for what you're doing. Then some of the heads of the children of Ephraim, Azariah the son of Johanan, Berechiah the son of Meshilemoth, Jehizkiah the son of Shallum, and Amasiah the son of Hadlai stood up against those who came from the war. So now some of the leading, some of the VIPs in the country also took that position and said to them, you shall not bring the captives here, for we already have offended the Eternal. You intend to add to our sins and to our guilt, for our guilt is great, for there is fierce wrath against Israel. So the armed men left the captives and the spoil before the leaders and all the assembly. Verse 15. Then the men who were designated by name rose up and took the captives, and from the spoil they clothed all those who were naked among them, dressed them and gave them sandals, gave them food and drink, and anointed them, and they let all the feeble ones ride on donkeys. So they brought them to their brethren at Jericho, the city of palm trees. Then they returned to Samaria. So there, this was an act of kindness and reconciliation. And so in that sense, that's a positive move. But unfortunately, it wasn't followed through sufficiently. But perhaps the idea there was that they wanted to work something out with Judah so that maybe Judah would still align themselves with the northern kingdom, with the Syrians against the Assyrians. But the Jews were really worried, and they went to the Assyrians. Verse 16. At the same time, King Ahaz sent to the kings of Assyria to help him. For again the Edomites had come, attacked Judah, and carried away captives. The Philistines also had invaded the cities of the lowland and of the south of Judah, and had taken Beth Shemesh, Ayalon, Gederoth, Soho, and its villages, Timnah with its villages, and Gimzo with its villages, and they dwelt there. And so, unfortunately, because of the sins of Judah, not only did they have an invasion from the north, but from the east and west. For the Eternal brought Judah low, because Ahaz, king of Israel, you know, he was king of the southern kingdom of Israel, which is called Judah, for he had encouraged moral decline in Judah, and had been continually unfaithful to the Eternal. He had over time shown himself to be that way. How sad. Also Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came to him and distressed him, and did not assist him. For Ahaz took part of the treasures from the house of the Eternal, from the house of the king, and from the leaders, and he gave it to the king of Assyria, but he did not help him. Now, in the time of his distress, King Ahaz becoming increasingly unfaithful to the Eternal. This is that King Ahaz. So Ahaz tried everything but the right thing. You know, he tried all the political shenanigans and all the, you know, the geopolitical and military shenanigans, but he didn't repent, didn't turn to God. So the Assyrians really didn't help him. Yes, they did conquer Syria and the northern kingdom. And so he didn't have that issue. However, at the same time, he had people invading from the east, people invading from the west. And he also very likely became at this point a what I would call a vassal state to Assyria, pretty much subject to Assyria in terms of his foreign policy had to coincide with Assyria, and he was very likely sending tribute there, as I read. So his nation became a kind of satellite of the Assyrians for a time. Okay, are you with me? So we see that a decline and fall of the northern kingdom, and the southern kingdom seems to be heading in that same direction. Fortunately, the next king was a righteous king and changed the direction of events for a time. But I want to go now back to 2 Kings 16, verse 29. In the days of Pekah, the king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Eon, Abel, Beth Maakad, Yanoah, Kedesh, Hazor, Gilead, and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive to Assyria. You know, so the Assyrians conquered Syria and much of Israel. And so now we have Hoshea, who is pro-Assyrian, and he now takes over Israel, and he assassinates Pekah. Another assassination. Then Hoshea, the son of Ella led a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck and killed him. So he reigned in his place in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. And once again, we're told that there are historical records. And by the way, there are records in the Assyrian chronicles that have been found. And so the Assyrians also talk about these events. In fact, I believe Tiglath-Pileser takes some credit for Hoshea's having taken over control of Israel. From his point of view, he claims to have, I think, conspired with Hoshea. Verse 31. Now the rest of the acts of Pekah and all that he did, indeed they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. So this is the situation that we have. Several assassinations have occurred. Civil war has occurred between Israel and Judah. Invasions have occurred of the northern kingdom. All this has happened. And now we come to the conclusion, to the climax, in the 17th chapter of 2 Kings. Hoshea turned out to be the final king of Israel, the northern kingdom. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea the son of Ella became king of Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 9 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Eternal, but not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Oh, so Hoshea wasn't quite as bad as the others, but unfortunately, you know, it was really too late to solve the problem. He might have if he had not decided to, in effect, double-cross the Assyrians. He made the mistake, of instead of remaining at peace with the Assyrians, of conspiring with the Pharaoh, getting together with Egypt to try to overthrow the Assyrians. So, in effect, things were getting better. He was not as wicked as the earlier kings. So it could be maybe some understanding could have been reached. But then he decided he would conspire with the Egyptians against the Assyrians. Well, that ended it. Verse 3. Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute money. And the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hoshea, for he had sent ambassadors to Saul, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. So now there really was no king in Israel anymore. And so now the people were holding out rather valiantly against Assyria, but they finally did lose after a 3-year siege. So in the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria, 722 BC, and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Hala and by the Habar, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the eternal to their God who had brought them out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods and had walked in the statutes of the nations whom the eternal had cast out from before the children of Israel and the kings of Israel which they had and of the kings of Israel which they had made. They followed a different way of life, very radically different from the way that they were taught, a depraved way of life, corrupt way of life. And now they were finally paying the price. And I could go on, but you could read about it here in 2 Kings 17. It's a summary of all that had happened. God had sent prophets to warn them, but they didn't listen. And they did horrible things that you can read about here. So let's go to verse 18, I guess is where I'll go. Okay, I'm in 2 Kings 17, 18. Therefore, the Eternal was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. Let's go to verse 41. Let's go to verse 40. However, let's go to verse 40 of 2 Kings 18. However, they did not obey, but they followed their former rituals. So these nations feared the Eternal. Now, here's what happened after the Israelites left. New people came in, Samaritans, they're called. And they were a mixture of the Israelites who were left behind and the Gentiles that were brought in, the Babylonians that were brought in to replace them. And they established a counterfeit religion, which continued to function all through history. There were the Samaritans to the north and the Jews to the south. And in the day of Jesus Christ, that was still the case. In Samaria, there were the Samaritans who had a religion that had similarities with what the Jews were doing, but yet, you know, it was their own brand. And that's the way it continued. And this is talked about here. In other words, they didn't go all the way. They didn't cleanse themselves of their paganism. Verse 40, however, they did not obey, but they followed their former rituals. So these nations feared the Eternal, yet served their carved images. Also their children and their children's children have continued doing as their fathers did, even to this day. So this is the story, the very sad story of the conclusion of the Northern Kingdom, the fall of the Northern Kingdom. And it's there for us to read about. It shows what can happen, you know, that you can get a slippery slope. As things begin to decline, the decline intensifies and it gets worse and worse. And because of the vulnerability, all kinds of things begin to happen. You know, one problem leads to another towards the end. Things just get out of hand and out of control, you know, and like an avalanche. And this is what finally happened. So these are written in the Bible so that we can read about these accounts and we can understand, you know, that there is a standard that nations need to maintain. There is a standard that civilizations need to maintain. And when they do not, the result is self-destructive. Nations that become corrupt, unfortunately, you know, if they become that way, it does lead to a self-destruct over time. So we can understand that. We can pray that wherever we live, that our leaders rule with wisdom, that they rule with morality. We could, in our own lives, try to contribute to that general atmosphere of wisdom and morality in the way we live and the way we affect other people in word and thought and in deed. And then we can look forward to the coming kingdom of God. We can represent it and we can look forward to it. I want to go to Revelation 11 and verse 15. Revelation 11 and verse 15. And this is where we're finally coming to. This is where history is going. Even though we read about a lot of tragedy in the Bible, and we read about a lot of tragedy in history, we know that ultimately things are going to work out for the best. God does have a plan of salvation. And we're now in step with it. If we're a part of the Church of God, we're in step with his plan. We're part of the solution. Not part of the problem, but part of the solution. So we can look forward to Revelation 11 and verse 15. Then the seventh angel sounded, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. So we can keep this conclusion in mind as we study the fall of the northern kingdom. I'd like to now go to Q and A. And just as I said, you know, in the northern kingdom, there were prophets who warned the people. One of the great prophets in the northern kingdom was the prophet Amos at the time of Jeroboam II. And his prophecies have had a great influence even on contemporary culture. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. was very much influenced by Amos. But in the pre-flood world, there was also a ministry. There was also a warning in the pre-flood world, because the ark must have been extremely difficult to build with the technology available at that time. It must have taken an awfully long time to build the ark. Now, while the ark was being built, I would suppose it would give the opportunity to explain to people, and I would imagine the story spread far and wide over time about it, because it certainly would have been a very odd thing to do. And so this project, I suppose a lot of people had to be employed in the project, a lot of materials had to be utilized, and a lot of time taken. So while this ark was being constructed, in effect, Noah could be preaching and warning. And evidently, Noah did have an extended ministry, a ministry of 120 years. I was asked a question about Genesis 6:3. Please explain Genesis 6:3. Let's go over there. Sometimes, even in modern times, there have been certain ministers who have lived a long time and have exerted influence over many decades. In Genesis 6:3, we see that evidently God gave to the pre-flood world 120 years, 3 times 40. As you know, 3 being the number of finality, 40 being the number of trial. And so Noah's ministry, one could say, was an 120-year ministry, after which time the floods did come. Genesis 6 and verse 3, and the Eternal said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. So I'm going to be patient, but I'm not going to be let this go on and on and on. But I'm going to give them 120 years, which he did. And then the flood came, the punishment came. 8 survived. And the world today is as it is, you know, coming from those 8, Noah, his wife, and 3 sons and their wives. So there was a 120-year ministry before that climax came. Now we are looking at a transition time before the second coming of Christ. We don't know how much time there is before that time. So we can just, in the meantime, do as best we can to set the right example and to continue to tell the truth as we're able to do so, and live it as best we can and share it as best we can. So if you have any questions you want to submit, please go ahead and do so. You can also, you know, you can use a special URL for that, cck153questions@gmail.org. .com. Yeah, I always make that mistake because the church is an org, you know. So cck153questions@gmail.com. Or if you want to communicate with the church directly, or check out our website, cck153.org. We also have a Facebook page, which I regularly post on. And again, I want to remind everybody, tomorrow is the new moon of the 6th month. So that means in a month, we're going to have the Festival of Trumpets. Monday, September 14th is the Festival of Trumpets. You're certainly welcome to come on down here, celebrate it with us here in Central Florida. And then we have the Day of Atonement coming up. I guess that would be on the 24th. And then we come to the Festival of Tabernacles. I don't want to misstate myself, because sometimes when I'm thinking out loud, I'm not thinking, I get ahead of myself. So let me just check this out. Day of Atonement is on the 23rd. Good, I'm glad I checked. So September 23rd is the Day of Atonement. It didn't seem right to me as I said it. September 23rd is the Day of Atonement. And then after that, we'll be in, God willing, Washington, D.C. for 7 days and then the 8th Day of Sacred Assembly. And we hope that many of you can be with us there. In the meantime, all the best to you and yours.